The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Wisdom of Hillel and Shammai, The Power of Love and Humility, is dedicated to the honor and merit of Chana Yocheved Bas Aaron Eliezer, Mrs. Ann Newman. The period covered in this year's series of Ovos, the period of the Zugos, the pairs of rabbinic leaders, starting from Yossi ben Yoezer Ish Sereda and Yossi ben Yochanan Ish Yerushalayim, were some of the most trying in our history. The period starting from Shemaya v'Avtalion, which was the subject of the last lecture, which witnessed a steep decline in the social, political, and religious spheres, wars, famine, and rule by the Sadducees, Idumeans, and Romans, was particularly difficult, but it was only the beginning. Under Herod, the son of Antipater, the Idumean, the Jewish people experienced such horrors that after his death they welcomed and requested direct rule from Rome, realizing that the corrupt and brutal administration of Rome was far superior to that of Herod and his children. In the words of the Jewish ambassadors to Rome after the death of Herod in the year 4 before the Common Era, and this is taken from Josephus's historic work Antiquities, this is book 17, chapter 11. Now upon the liberty that was given to the Jewish ambassadors to speak, they who hoped to obtain a dissolution of kingly government, as they wanted the Romans to really to eject Herod, you know, Herod had died, but his family, and directly rule, betook themselves to accuse Herod of his iniquities, and declare that he was indeed in name a king, but that he had taken to himself that uncontrollable authority which tyrants exercise over their subjects, and had made use of that authority for the destruction of the Jews, and did not abstain from making many innovations among them besides, according to his own inclinations, and that whereas there were a great many who perished by the destruction he brought upon them, so many indeed as no other history relates. They that survived were far more miserable than those that suffered under him, not only by the anxiety that they were in from his looks and disposition towards them, but from the danger their estates were of being taken by him. That he did never leave off adorning these cities that lay in their neighborhood, but were inhabited by foreigners. Thus Herod was his mandate by the Romans was to be the king of the Jews in Judea. But he didn't feel as a Jew. And therefore, but he built in all of these pagan cities. And if you were in Israel, if you saw the ruins of Caesarea, you know, it's by the sea, you know, there's an amphitheater. This was built by Herod. He built this magnificent city, but it was a pagan city. By and large, the Jewish cities were neglected. But so that the cities belonging to his own government were ruined and utterly destroyed, that whereas when he took the kingdom it was in an extraordinary flourishing condition, he had filled the nation with the utmost degree of poverty, and when, upon unjust pretenses, he had slain any of the nobility, he took away their estates. When he permitted any of them to live, he condemned them to the forfeit of what they possessed. It sounds like the communists. You know? How bad it was under the Tsar, but after the communists took over, for the most part, people wished, you know that the Tsar had remained. I mean, for the most part. And besides the annual impositions which he laid upon every one of them, the taxes, that were to make liberal presents to himself, to his domestics and his friends, and to such of his slaves as were vouchsafed the favor of being his tax gatherers, because there was no way of obtaining a freedom from unjust violence without giving either gold or silver for it. Because they have to keep on bribing. It's like in South America, in Latin America, where really you just have to, or in the Middle East, people who do business know that you just can't do business, you know, under normal circumstances. That they would say nothing of the corruption of the chastity of their virgins and the reproach laid on the wives for incontinency, in other words, adultery, and those things acted after an insolent and inhuman manner, because it was not a smaller pleasure to the sufferers to have such things concealed than it would have been not to have suffered them. Now, this evidently he made after he did, you know, he did what he then says that he made it public, so the embarrassment was terrible. That Herod had put such abuses upon them as a wild beast would not have put upon them if he had power given him to rule over us. In other words, a beast would have done a better job than Herod would. And that although their nation had passed through many subversions and altercations of government, their history gave no account of any calamity that they had ever been under that could be compared with this which Herod had brought upon their nation. But in the midst of all of this suffering, God sent us a gentle angel that brought in a new and glorious era of saintliness in Torah scholarship. His name was Hillel. The Talmud describes the circumstances of how he was chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people, Klal Yisrael. Here it's on page 2 if you have notes. Our rabbis taught this halacha, this law was hidden, B'nai B'Seira. The B'nai B'Seira, evidently after the death of Shemaiah and Aptalion, these were the leaders of the rabbinic court, there was a void of leadership. And it seems B'nai B'Seira was a rabbinic family. And they as a family took charge. But they were not, you know, they were scholars, but not of the highest level. But on one occasion, the 14th of Nisan, is the day before Passover, where the Passover lamb, the Korban Pesach, was brought, it fell on the Sabbath. And they didn't know whether Passover overrides the Sabbath or not. In other words, the day before Passover, that was the 15th. So in the afternoon of the 14th, they bring, you know, the Korban Pesach. There's a Paschal lamb. There's a sacrifice which is brought. What about Shabbos? Normally, Shabbos, you don't do work. So when you have these together, what are you supposed to do? They didn't know. It could be they had avoided it, you know, because you could fix with the calendar. So they had avoided it coming. But for some reason, it happened to come under their reign. They said, is there any man who knows whether the Passover overrides the Sabbath or not? They were told there's a certain man who had come up from Babylon, Hillel HaBavli, Hillel the Babylonian is his name, who served, he studied under the two greatest men of the time, that Shemaiah and Aftalion, and he knows whether the Passover overrides the Sabbath or not. And this is a person of real stature who's come amongst us. Thereupon they summoned him and said to him, do you know whether the Passover overrides the Sabbath or not? And that he continues on, he proved to them that the Passover supersedes the Sabbath. So in the Korban Pesach, when the Paschal lamb is brought even on Shabbos, they immediately set him at their head and appointed him Nasi, patriarch over them. On page 2. Yeah. So he became, they realized he was a superior person. The Talmud Yerushalmi points out the courage and the humility that it took for them to give up their position. As we had discussed in the previous lecture, it is very difficult for people to give up a position of power. Within the story of Hillel, you know, the famous Hillel. But not only was Hillel recognized by the Jewish community, but he was well respected by Herod, who was the king and who was the tyrant, and we discussed honestly as well. And this is how Josephus, he was the historian of the period, described it. But Pollio, this is how he calls Hillel, the Pharisee was the rabbi, and Sammeus, that's Shammai, a disciple of his, were honored by him above all the rest. For when Jerusalem was besieged, there was a period which we discussed the last lecture, there was a whole, the kings before Herod were the Maccabees. The last of the Maccabee kings, his name was Antigonus. And he held Jerusalem against the Romans from the year 40 before the Common Era to the year 37 before the Common Era. Rome appointed Herod to be the king of the Jews. And together with a Roman legion, they attacked Jerusalem. And during this time, this is 37 before the Common Era. So when Jerusalem was besieged, they advised the citizens, and this is Hillel and Shammai, to receive Herod. Herod was on the outside. And they told him it's not worth the... Yeah. Just sit down. It's not worth the... all the blood that will be shed. You realize you're going to lose already. Bring him in. For which advice they were well requited. But because he saved all their lives, and Herod was appreciative for this. But this Pollio, this is the way he calls Hillel, at the time when Herod was once upon his trial of life and death, this was some years before, foretold in a way of reproach to Hyrcanus, who was then the leader, and the other judges, that if you let this man free, you're going to suffer for it. How this Herod, whom they suffered now to escape, would afterwards inflict punishment on them all, which had its completion in time. Eventually, this Herod killed Hyrcanus and all the other people because they didn't have the courage to stand up to Herod when they had. But Hillel was there, and he told them, "If you don't have the courage now, you're going to suffer later." While God fulfilled the words he had spoken. So these were people of integrity. And he continues on later, Josephus. He says, he endeavored also to persuade Pollio, and Hillel the Pharisee, and Shammai, Sammius, and the greatest part of their scholars to take the oath of allegiance. But these would neither submit so to do, nor were they punished together with the rest out of the reverence he bore to Pollio. In other words, he felt he was a murderer, and he wasn't going to swear allegiance to such a person. But he knew he was a man of integrity. He was a man of truth, and he respected him. So Hillel was an unusual person. If we could isolate one midah, one special quality that Hillel possessed, besides for his giant intellect, it would be his humility and patience. I'm going to read to you, those who have, unfortunately, I didn't make enough handouts here for... Rabbi, this is taken from the Talmud. It's a beautiful story. And it gives you just an idea who Hillel was. I mean, there are many yeshivas named after Hillel, and you'll see why. A man should always, the Talmud says, this is at the bottom of in Shabbos 30b, a man should always be gentle like Hillel and not impatient like Shammai. It once happened that two men made a wager with each other, saying, "The one who successfully makes Hillel angry will receive 400 zuz." You see, 200 zuz was the poverty line for a person and his wife. In other words, if you owned that much money, you were not eligible for charity. If you less, you were eligible for charity. A person could live on the poverty line for 200 zuz a year. So this was 400 zuz. So I don't know what the poverty level is today, 20,000 for a 25, 30, so it's twice as much. So it was a considerable amount of money, you know, for that time. One of them said, "I'll go and infuriate him. I'll be the one, you know, and then I'll take..." I guess they must have put the money in a kitty, you know, and the one who... That day was Erev Shabbos, was Sabbath Eve, and Hillel was washing his head. He went and passed by the door of his house and called out. There's this man who wanted to anger Hillel. "Is Hillel here? Is Hillel here?" You know, like treating... He is a man. He became the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, was 80 years old. And it was like a miracle. He lived to be 120, and he was active till the end. So it's hard to know, but he's an elderly person. I can imagine those who made the wager were in their high teens, early 20s. So they're addressing him just, it was Hillel. Hillel was busy, was washing, getting ready for Shabbos. Thereupon Hillel robed, put on his clothes, and went out to him saying, "My son, what do you need?" "I have a question to ask." "No, ask my son." Thereupon he asked, "Why are the heads of the Babylonians round?" You know, they have funny shaped head. You know, this is all he needs. You know, it's Erev Shabbos. And if you, there is like in a Jewish home, like right before Shabbos, it gets busy. You know, and this is the big question he asks. I don't know what your response would be, but he said, "My son, you've asked a great question." He says, "Because they have no skilled midwives." He departed. Okay, the guy thanked him, left, waited a while, came back, and, "Hey, is Hillel here? Is Hillel here?" He robed and went out to him. He says, "My son, what do you want?" "I have a question to ask." "Ask my son." "Why are the eyes of the Palmyrians..." This is a bleared. Palmyra was a city, and if you're familiar with the history, there are tremendous ruins there. It's in Syria. And it was a major trading route. And this Palmyra, though, was in the middle of a desert. The people of Palmyra, their eyes were red. I mean, they always had like bloodshot eyes. Or it was a question how to read the text. What's the problem with their eyes? "Again, my son, you've asked a great question. Because they live in sandy places." It was in the desert. You know, so I guess the wind, you know, carries the sand particles in their eyes. Okay, he departed, waited a while, returned to call. "Hey, is Hillel here?" Again, "Is Hillel here?" So again, put on his clothes, went out. "So, what do you want, my son?" "I have a question to ask." "Ask my son." "Why are the feet of the Africans wide?" You know, Africans always, like as if he said, you know, "I have a shoe store," you know. They always order triple E. You know, why is that? He says, "My son, you've asked a good question." He says, "Because they live in marshy, watery marshes, I guess it has to be wider." In other words, that they should, you know, have more balance. "I have many questions to ask, but I'm afraid you're going to become angry." Hillel, again, evidently he, you know, got dressed. Evidently he went back, and then again he went and asked him. "Ask all the questions you want to ask. Are you Hillel, who's called the Nossi, the Prince of Israel?" "Yeah." "If that's you," says, "there shouldn't be many like you. There shouldn't be many like you in Israel." "What I do?" "Why, my son?" "Because I've lost 400 zoos because of you." "You're a menace." Says, "Be careful of your, you know, of your emotions, of your moods," he said. "Hillel is worth it that you should lose 400 and another 400. Hillel, you're not going to make angry." That was the kind of person he was. Then there's another incident that they discuss. So it's one, something we have to learn from. You know, it's how much, you know, that for little things we get angry. And here is, I mean, this was a nudge. "Our rabbis taught," again, there's another story, "a certain heathen," was a non-Jew, "once came before Shammai." And this is the difference between Shammai and Hillel. "How many Torahs have you?" So he says, "We have two, the written Torah and the oral Torah." There's the oral tradition to understand this. "I believe you with respect to the written, but not respect to the oral. But make me a proselyte, make me a ger, a convert, on condition you teach me the written Torah only." It would seem that had he been reasonable, Shammai was also an elderly person. We're dealing the time when Hillel was the Nasi. Shammai was an elderly person. Generally, and it has in this community, I would think in probably many communities, when as someone who's not Jewish and wants to convert and is serious, they probably won't go to the greatest rabbi in the entire community to teach him. They'll probably go to someone who's committed and knowledgeable, but not the person who's the greatest rabbi has many, many students, many communal responsibilities, and this is probably, you know, it's something that someone else could do. It seems Shammai would have been willing to deal with the person and spend time with the person had he felt that he was really sincere. But here's a person who says, "Well, I only believe in one and not the other, and I want to make," you know, he says, "You know, don't make me conditions for conversion." But Shammai repulsed him. He scolded and repulsed him in anger. But he was still, this person was sincere. I mean, he really wanted to become a Jew. When he went before Hillel, Hillel said, "Sure, good." He accepted him as either a candidate or as a convert. On the first day, but you know, you have to know something, you know. So let's start learning. So he start, you know, with the aleph base. You know, this is an aleph, this is a base, this is a gimel, this is a dalet. The following day, okay, now we're going to go review the lesson, you know. The first, okay, there's enough letters for you in one day, you know, we'll go, you know. Go home, you know, review this and we'll go back. Next day he comes, he says, he reversed the order. You know, he called this the aleph, now he called that a dalet. You know, it was really confusing. The gimel, he called that a beis. So he says, "Wait a minute, that's not the way you taught me yesterday." He says, "How do you know I was right yesterday? You're relying upon me. I mean, basically, how do you know anyone know this is an aleph is an aleph?" You know, so Gemara says everyone knows, because ultimately, that's what the last generation taught us. So he says, if you rely upon me, I mean basically the tradition, that an aleph is an aleph and a beis is a beis, you can rely upon me with the other aspects of the tradition as well. He accepted it. So instead of pushing him away, he did it in a gentle manner. The Gemara goes on to two other cases, but each one is there's much to learn from them. And again, I believe when the Gemara tells us these stories, it's not just to tell us the greatness of Hillel, which is true, but it's somehow to impart some of the greatness of Hillel to us. You know, we often, you know, make the mistake, as we're going to see, that that being a great person or a learned person only deals with issues between man and God. Greatness deals how you deal with other people. You know, and this is, I think this is all part of, you know, there's a beautiful story that there was someone came to one of the great Hasidic rabbis in Europe, one of the Hasidic rabbis, the Kotzker Rebbe. Kotzk so he boasted to the Rebbe, he says, "I learned through the entire Talmud. Durkalan Ganshas. I learned through the entire Talmud." And the Kotzker says, "And what did the Talmud teach you?" It isn't just reading it through. How did that information affect you? And I think that's all part of this process. On another occasion it happened that a certain heathen came before Shammai and said to him, "Make me a proselyte," and was make me a ger, a convert, "on condition you teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot." You know, there's a famous story. Thereupon he came to Shammai. He repulsed him with the builder's cubit which was in his hand. I guess he was doing something, you know, in the house repairs or something, which is indicative that he probably, you know, he was self-supporting. You know? And again, it seems had he asked something reasonable, he would have taken the time. It wasn't, but he felt that the time was also a time, as we're going to see, where there are all kinds of different sects. You know, we know about the sect of those who lived in the Dead Sea, you know, kind of Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are all kinds of different sects, there are all kinds of different people. It was a time that Shammai, if had he been sincere, would have spent the time with him. But he felt for these people, Hillel, of course, is something, this is what the Talmud wants us. Even in those times, and these kinds of people, you should bring them close with love. When he went before Hillel, he said to him, "I'll teach you the whole Torah on standing one foot. What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow man." That's the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. Just go and learn it. But that's the whole Torah. So they explain. So Rashi is bothered there. That's fine for that part which is between man and man. But there's a whole part which is between man and God. There's Shabbos. There's Kasher. There's a lot of other things. So Rashi gives two answers. One answer is, but the majority of mitzvahs that we do, the majority of opportunities that we have are connected between man and man. Okay, you get up in the morning, you daven. The rest of the day, you're in business. You're dealing with people. You're dealing with colleagues, with clients, with employers, with employees, with friends. There's a question of honesty. There's a question of to help the other person. When you say hello to your secretary, it isn't just, you know, they're a person. They probably have problems. They have marital problems. They have problems with their kids. They have all kinds of service. You know, you look at them. You know, they're a person. You give them, you know, you make them feel good. You know, that's whatever is hateful. So, in truth, the opportunities to do mitzvahs, the majority are between man and man. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, this is how Rashi is saying, you know, that which is distasteful for you, don't do to someone else. He says, God is not worse than a person. You know, and he quotes a verse to say that, they quote the verse views, treats, you know, calls God your friend. He says, you know, God put so much into you. He gave you so much. Where's your appreciation? If someone would do so much to you, you know, you have children. You put all the effort into children. What do parents want out of kids? They don't want money. They want some nachas. That's all they want is nachas. So he says, Hashem, this God put so much into you. Why don't you give him some nachas? You know? He asks so much for you, and all that he asks is really for your benefit anyway. So that's a second way of Rashi. I heard, I'm sure there are many, many other things, because it's one of the most beautiful things about the study of Torah is there's so much room for genius, you know, for ingenious approaches, and many of them probably are right also and included in this. But one of them I heard is a beautiful approach. The Talmud says, the Gemara in Kedushin and Daf Mem, that we are weighed, as we, the world, is weighed, you know, by merits and demerits. Only God knows the, but there's a weighing. There's a weighing for an individual. There's a weighing for a city. There's weighing, you know, a scales and accountability for the whole world. Imagine, if you would, that the world is just holding half and half. And I want to do something which is wrong, and I'm going to have a tremendous amount of pleasure. But in the process, I'm going to tip the scales. So everybody else is going to suffer, and they're not going to have the pleasure. At least when I do something wrong, I have the pleasure. Why does the other person have to suffer? So that's not something that I would like. So you should realize that everything you do affects everyone else. You know, it's like the story about the guy who's in the boat and he starts drilling a hole by his seat. And the guy said, what are you doing? I'm drilling a hole. What do you mean? He says, well, listen, I don't tell you what to do by your seat. Don't tell me what to do by my seat. So the important is we're all in the same boat. And whatever we do affects someone else. So it's even, so there's everything we do, we should take that in mind. What's distasteful, don't do, says whatever you're doing, you're affecting somebody else. That's also a very nice way of looking at things. That's the second story. The third story is, on another occasion, that a certain heathen, a non-Jew, was passing behind a study hall, a Beis Medrash. He heard the voice of a teacher reciting, and it was about the garments of the high priest. These are the garments which they shall make, a breastplate, an ephod is like an apron. And he asked the non-Jew, for whom are these? I guess he was teaching it in Aramaic, some of the language he could understand. For the high priest, he was told. So the non-Jew said to himself, that's pretty good. You know, I'll become a convert, I'll become a high priest. It's worth it. So he went before Shammai and said to him, you know, make me a ger, a proselyte, a convert, on condition that you appoint me to be high priest. So you can figure what Shammai did to the guy. He still had that builder's thing in his thing, and he threw him out. The person went to Hillel. Of course, Hillel made him a convert, or began the process. But he said to him, you know, a person can't become a king, or, you know, until you know the art of government. You know, we have to need training here. So let's study how to become a high priest. So he went on. So they started studying. And they came to the verse, and the stranger that comes near, you know, to the service in the temple shall be put to death. He says, who does this verse apply to? It says, even to King David. So he says, wait a minute, King David. It says, you know, he's a naturally born Jew. He has a genealogy. He has generations. You know, he says, they're called the sons of God. In his love, he designated them Israel. He quotes the verses, B'ni B'chayr Yisrael is my firstborn. And yet, even for such a person, it says that for a stranger, non-Cohen is put to death. How much more so me? I don't have a genealogy. Every one of us could point to, you know, Azeda, you know, who knows where we come from great people. He says, I come from nothing. Then he went before, so he understood already. He was still at that point willing to remain a Jew. He came back to Shammai and said, just why do you throw me out? Why don't you just tell me I can't become the high priest? And then, you know, he quoted the verse. Then he went before Hillel and he said, O gentle Hillel, blessings rest on your head for bringing me under the wings of the Shekhinah, divine presence. Sometimes later, the three met in one place. And they said, Shammai's impatience sought to drive us from this world, but Hillel's gentleness brought us under the wings of the Shekhinah. So this is who Hillel was. It was in this most difficult time under Herod that Hillel inspired and comforted his people and enabled them to continue to grow spiritually and intellectually. The mission of Ovos preserved many of his aphorisms, many of his things, which I believe, although their timeless message speaks also to us, they're uniquely suited to his times, because it was a time there was tremendous rifts amongst the Jewish, something like today, you know, the tremendous rifts, tremendous hatred and passion. So Hillel, this is on page 5, Hillel and Shammai received the oral tradition from them, Shammai and Naphtali, their teachers in the previous generation. Hillel says, you should become disciples of Aaron, love peace, pursue peace, love one's fellow creatures and bring them closer to the Torah. That was his saying. You can imagine in those times how apropos those words were. I didn't have time to translate this, but you'll have to trust me. In Ovos to Rabbi Nosson, Ovos to Rabbi Nosson is an expanded form of Pirkei Ovos that has much more material. So it brings it says about the idea of loving peace, and he says it teaches one should love peace amongst fellow Jews just like Aaron loved peace. And it quotes a posuk, Teres Emes Hoysu Befihu, as opposed to Malachi, the prophet Malachi, in chapter 2. The Torah of truth was in his mouth. There was no crookedness in his lips. Bisholom of Misha Holoch Iti. With me he went with peace and straightness. Verabim Heshiv Ma'ovon. He brought many people away from sin. So he says, how did he bring people away from sin? And, you know, there are different methods. Aaron was the brother of Moshe. He was the first high priest. This is it. When he died, and this was in the last in the Torah reading last week, V'yifkos a kol beis Yisrael, the entire Jewish people cried for his death. There wasn't anyone who didn't feel his loss. How did he bring people away from sin? Generally, those who take the direct approach have enemies. You know, it says you're doing this wrong or that wrong. Aaron didn't tell anybody anything, but everybody felt that Aaron was their best friend. He would see the worst kinds of people and give them shalom. How are you? How was the mishpacha? How was your wife? How was the kids? They would feel Aaron is my best friend. The next day they want to do something wrong and says, How could I look at Aaron again? He trusts me. He thinks, he looks at me as a colleague. How could I lower myself? And that prevented them from sinning. You know, it's basically as if a, I mean, part of the of you know, when people are depressed, unfortunately, you do a lot of things that later on you're sorry for. Because I'm a nobody, I'm a nothing. What difference does it make? But there's certain things when you view yourself on a certain level, you know, in Yiddish it says sepasnisht. The students are unbecoming. I can't do that. So when they looked at Aaron was their best friend, it was unbecoming. Because a person really looks at themselves, I'm really a somebody. Not necessarily because I'm so smart or so wealthy or so talented musically. Just because being a human being, just being B'Tselem Elokim Migal, I'm worth so much. So you're not gonna. When he would see two people, when he would two people argue, he was a master of the white lie. He would go to one of them and says, you know what, I was just by your friend, which he wasn't. You know, he's really besides himself. He's tearing out his heart. He's, how could he have, you know, these two people got into a fight. So he made up, you know, he holds you in the highest regard. He doesn't know what came over him. Anyways, then he goes to the other person, tells the exact same lie. Finally, says, and he plants the seed. When those two people see each other in the street, oh, Chaim, Yanko, you know, they kiss and hug each other. He says, this is what Aaron used to do. It goes on. He spent time in marriage counseling. He said, he spent time bringing people together. And this is the idea of running after peace. You know, sometimes, and this is a great show, sometimes you're not a person who's going to start a fight. And if things come your way, you'll try to make peace. But Aaron went out of his way, you know, to make peace. That's a road of shalom, one who runs after peace. You know, sometimes said in some cities, it's a name of a synagogue, road of shalom. You know, it's not uncommon. You know, it comes from here. The idea of not just being peaceful, but pursuing peace. And it says also the idea of makarv, the Torah, bringing people close to the Torah. And this was something he was concerned with. The Jewish people traced their roots to Avram and Sora. And it refers to them, in Nefesh Asher also b'choron. Before they came to Israel, they were in this town in Syria called Choron. And they influenced people. They touched people. There's really... You know, very often we have this false sense of humility. I mean, everyone should be humble, of course, but sometimes we have a false sense of humility. And you know, what could I teach? What do I know? Ben Agolnish, or what do I am? Whatever you know, you probably know a lot more than a lot of other people, and there's a lot that you can share. Like, you know, when you give the gift of Torah, you've given a whole meaning to people. Now I was this afternoon I spent some time with a couple, and you know we were talking, you know, and she comes from a secular background, and it was saying that, you know, there's so many people who live empty lives. You know, if you don't believe in the idea of an afterlife, you know, of life after death, you don't believe in the idea of accountability, so you're not going any place. It doesn't make a difference. The good person, the bad person, they all end up the same. If a person has the idea of a spirit, you know, you have a spiritual view of life. What you do counts. Ultimately, you'll be judged for what you've done. But you're expected. You know, it's like, I don't know if you've ever had this situation. You have two kids come in the house. One of the kids happens to be your kid. One of the children happens to be somebody else's child. You may be annoyed with somebody else's child, but with your child, you're really bothered. It's your kid, you know what I mean? Somebody else is new. This is my kid. Yeah. You know, but the fact is that even when we go through difficulties in life, if we have the feeling, well, this is all part of God's plan, you know, He's concerned with us. So even when things are we know, He's with us, and He's with us then he expects things from us. So really, I'm somebody of worth. I can do something. If you can't do anything, you just, you know, you let the person just play. I mean, you can't do anything. But when the person you expect from you, you take them to, you're much better than that. You can do this, you can do that. You know, God has expectations of us. You know, and you have a sense, therefore, of a purpose. My life means something, and I'm going someplace in life. And if you can impart the wisdom of Torah and that sense of purpose, you've created meaning in a person's life. You know, so many people just have such empty lives. I mean, it's full of toys, you know, and full of games, and full of, but it's full of, like, at the end of the thing, when you go to sleep at night, it's a puss, there's nothing. You're not going any place, you're not moving anywhere. And giving a person a sense of purpose and mission in life, it gives them a dignity. You give them so much. And every one of us, you don't know how much Torah you really know. You know, if you've gone through in your life and how much you could really impart to someone else. And really, this is not just for rabbis, you know, or Talmid HaChachamim, you know, great scholars. Every one of us can bring somebody a little closer. It's important. You know, we know that there's a tremendous mitzvah of tzedakah, of sharing our wealth. And we feel, you see people that are impoverished, people really need. But there's a spiritual wealth also. And you could give that as well. You don't know how wealthy you really are. You know, but you can really give it if it's a neighbor, it's a friend, even if it's a shoulder to cry on. And to give them words of encouragement, which is really our tradition, it's the Torah. You don't know how much you've given them. Briefly, Hillel had other aphorisms of his time, which are also very, very important here. And this is on page 6. Hu ho ya'omer, negad shmo avad shmei. He who seeks renown will lose his reputation. As a person should do the right thing. Don't look that people should go, and as you're doing the right thing, you know, seif ha'kavod lavo. The honor will come eventually. But the important thing is do it because it's there. Don't do it, you know, to gain a reputation. You know, if you're deserving, you'll get it anyway. And he says, is one who does not add to his Torah knowledge causes it to decrease. You know, we're always forgetting. And that's the human condition, you know, unfortunately. You know, as you grow older, you forget more. You know, it's like the very cute story about the a person had a friend over his home, and they were sitting in the living room, and the wife was in the kitchen. And the one friend was saying to the other, you know, says, you know, I'm getting older, and my memory is slipping a little, but I discovered this wonderful school. That it gives you, you know, there's certain techniques that you could use in mnemonics to remember things and visualize things. It's changed my life. He says, really? What's the name of the school? What's the name of that flower? You know, it has red, you know, red petals, you know, and it has thorns from the side. A rose. Yeah, a rose. Hey, Rose, what's the name of that school? So forgetting is part of the human condition. However, that's why you have to keep on. Like, it's life, you know, they say, like, life is like on a down escalator. If you keep on going up, you at least, you maintain equilibrium. You keep on a little faster, So he says one should also keep on adding his knowledge. At least ultimately you won't cause a decrease because we naturally forget. He who refuses to study, but then you have the opportunity to study, you just turn your back, he says, is condemned to death. I mean, because you have the most precious thing in the world. You know, this is God's gift to man. Even non-Jews, you know, it's a terrible thing that you see. I mean, it's not many, but there are people, you know, non-Jews who know the Bible much better than Jews. It's a shrek. But Jews, it's their Torah. They should. Says if you don't, you turn your back to it. Listen, we all have time limits. We have limits of intellect. We have limits of time. But don't turn your back to it. You should every day there should be some chunk of time, you know, devoted to the study of Torah. Whoever exploits the crown of Torah shall pass away. In other words, don't use it for your own benefit. And and this they explain on different levels. Don't see your self-aggrandizement. In other words, just because you're a scholar, they speak about using the divine names, you know, for your own, you know, for your own purposes. I don't know if it really falls into that category, but now that there's much publicity about the Kabbalah Center, you know, and about the idea of saying certain verses or certain, you know, have in mind certain things, and it'll guarantee you who knows what. The importance of life is being a humble servant of God. We're here on this earth for a short period of time. God expects many great things from us, and when we do a mitzvah, means we're doing it as we're God's employees. You know, you expect your employees to listen to you. You know, that's what we are. We're God's employees. And we have to do the right thing, you know, and for its own sake. You know, to use all these things is just help. I don't know if there is or there isn't, you know, what intrinsic value there is. But that's not the essence of what Judaism is. He also said, I'll just leave with this final thing from Hillel, who Hoya Omer used to say, Im ein ani li, mi li. If I'm not for myself, who's going to be for me? You know, people, there was a famous play, Waiting for Godot, you know, by Samuel Beckett, you know, about these schnorrers. You know, there's these beggars that are waiting for this gevir, you know, this philanthropist to go and help them. You have to take it. In other words, no one's going to help you. Listen, God's going to help you, but you have to make the first step. If you're not going to be... On the other hand, if I'm for myself, what am I? And there's a question how to interpret this, but many interpret it... But a person should have a humble sense of, still, despite all of this, what you accomplish in life is limited. I mean, even if now you've directed, now I've done everything. And a person should have a humble attitude. A person realizes his limitations and... Because even though he is well accomplished, but even the most well accomplished person, you know, still in all. It says, V'im lo achshav emosai, and if not now, when? Very often we always have this view, mañana, you know, tomorrow. Yeah, you know, tomorrow. If it's worth doing, now. That's an important thing. Shammai, it's interesting. Shammai left us, besides, of course, his teachings in the Talmud, he left us with three sayings. One is, it says, Asei Toros Hakeva. Treat your Torah study as a permanent part of your life. In other words, it isn't like just to have time. Like people just generally don't skip lunch, maybe, you know, or supper for sure or not. You know, it's part of your life, you know. Everyone brushes their teeth in the morning, you know. You study Torah, it's part of your life. You can't, whatever it is, it's 5 minutes, it's 10 minutes, but Torah is part of your life. Emor ma'at v'asei harbe. Say little and do much. You know, a lot of, you know, it was just very cute. I remember a magid, you know, like a traveling preacher once came here, and he was just saying so cutely, he said, you know, the difference between the previous generation and ours. In the previous generation, they used to kiss the Torah with their mouth. You know, some of you ever seen, you know, they bring the Torah, they've seen the mouth. And they used to give tzedakah, they gave charity with their hand. That they actually gave it. Today, they kiss the Torah with the hand, you know. And they give charity only with their mouth. And they never do it, you know, like it's cute. So he says, you know, the important thing is, emor ma'at v'asei harbe. Say little and do much. And the finds of a heavy mekavelus kol odom v'saber ponim yafos. And receive everyone with a pleasant face. So how does, you know, we've just read this whole story about Shammai, and he threw him out twice with a stick in his hand. Those were situations where he felt that it was an affront to him and the Torah, but under normal circumstances, he would have willingly accepted the convert and spent the time, even though he's the great scholar, he would have spent the time with him. But for such people, but the Talmud says even for such people, you have to bend over backwards to be nice. But Shammai was also so that you should receive warmly. You know, there's nothing like a smile. You know, someone comes. You know, we're so really, it's interesting, that's part of the human condition. We're really so desperate for recognition. Not recognition, you know, you're a great pianist or a violinist or, you know, it's a recognition that you're a mensch. You know? And everyone wants that recognition. And it's important to give it to people. You know, that you're a mensch. You're also a mensch. You're a person. You're worth something. And actually, they just quoting from Avraham Rabbi Nosson. So he says, "Kol makabel es chaveru b'sefer panim yafos." Person receives this with a nice countenance. This is in page 8. "Afilu Nosson loy klum." You gave him nothing. "Milo of akos of scripture considered kilu Nosson loy kol matonus tovo shavolam." You gave him the best presence of the world. Now, very often someone comes to you to ask you for financial help, and sometimes you can't. On your own, you can't give him everything he needs. And sometimes, various times, you yourself are limited. So, from the Talmud, it says that giving someone charity is blessed with 6 blessings. But cheering the person up is 11 blessings. Sometimes you say, really, I wish I could help you more. But you should know, you should have bracha, hatzlach, and Hashem should give you. You give a person, you give him a blessing, you give him a hope, and it's very much, much more important than the money you're actually giving. I mean, of course, you should try, but it's important you give the person dignity. To put it in the context, just to finish up here, to put it in the context of the times, we said the times were difficult times. The end of the first chapter of Avos ends with the teachings of the progeny, the descendants of Hillel. Hillel had a son, Shimon. Hillel died at the age of 120. So when Hillel died, I don't know how old his son Shimon was, but he probably was not a young man. Virtually nothing is known of him, all just that he had that name. There's one passage in the Talmud, the Gemara in Shabbos, and Tesfovim, and all of them 15a. But his grandson, Rabban Gamliel, is well known. He's well known in the Talmud. He's well known in the New Testament. In fact, there's a story, the story of the apostles, you know, after Yeshu, that Paul was, which really created reforms within the church. I mean, the fact is that they are not observant. They is because of Paul, and there was a whole mob that was fomenting against Paul, and Paul said, "I sat at the feet of Gamliel." You know, like I learned by the Rosh Yeshiva, you know, I sat by Gamliel's feet, you know, I'm a somebody. But the saying the word Gamliel was magic, because he was very, very well respected. But there were very difficult times. And even we spoke about Shammai and Hillel, in their disciples, their whole machlokas, and there were whole arguments and halacha between them, as if some of the Torah had been forgotten during that time. So it's in that light we can have Rabban Gamliel, you say, appoint a teacher for yourself and remove doubt. In other words, person needs a teacher, just check what the facts are. And you can, don't make a habit of tithing by guesswork. Then they used to give tithes, you know, a tenth. If you do it by guesswork, you're going to do it wrong. You know, make sure it isn't just about right. It's right. And if anyone has a business, he knows you don't want to. It's okay. You know, you want it right. You know, it's my wife is a math teacher. You know, and they said, "What do I have to know all these things for?" You know, with the decimals. She says, "Look, if you're not worried about a decimal, write me a check." You know, it's got to be right. You know what I mean? You got to know where to put the decimal point. You know, in the right place. He had a son, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Shimon Gamliel already was at the time of the destruction of the temple. The temple part was destroyed because of ill will, because of lashon hara, because of So it's interesting in that sense. What is his dictum? Shimon, his son, used to say, I've grown up among sages my entire life and I haven't found anything better for a person than silence. I mean, these are lessons for life, but you know, it had particular meaning then. Study is not the essential thing, but rather implementing it into action. You know, it's easy to talk, you know, but the important thing is to take what you've learned and integrate it into your life and implement it. And he says, and whoever indulges in too many words brings about sin. You know, you schmooze this, you schmooze that, then you start thinking you shouldn't be speaking, and then you start besmirching the other people. Just use your words wisely. He had a son, this Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, who was the leader of Jewry after the temple was destroyed. And they had to rebuild Jewish life. It was a tremendous change. The center was the temple. Of course, there was learning Torah, but there was no temple anymore. And then he had to create like a whole new paradigm for life. So it's interesting. His will conclude with his saying, Rabban Shimon, so Rabban Shimon Gamliel now is the son of Rabban Gamliel. Now, so this is another generation. So he said, Shimon Gamliel says, the world endures through three things. Rabban Shimon Gamliel lived during the time, not only Rabban Gamliel lived after the time of destruction of the temple. Afterwards, there was a revolt in Beitar, you know, the revolt of Bar Kokhba. After that, everything was lost. His son, Shimon, was the leader during those terrible times where all hope was lost. The world endures through three things. On justice, so this is Al Adin, Val Emes, Val Shalom. On justice, on truth, on peace. This is what we have to concentrate on. There should be a just society. There should be truth. There should be integrity. And peace. And for peace, you go without to make peace. You know, very often even when you're right, you say you're wrong, so there should be peace. So even though sometimes the peace overrides the truth. And these were the leaders, you know, in those difficult times.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.